The name of this song is...
What's it like for David Byrne to watch old videos of Talking Heads?
This is a person who is profoundly uncomfortable addressing an audience and yet puts himself in that position.
Why did he do that?
I think he did that because he had to.
It's just another day at the office watching rock and roll home videos with David Byrne.
My job is teaching, and your job is learning.
And say goodbye to little red schoolhouses with apples on the teacher's desk. We hired graphic designers to give education a modern update. Later, we'll trace the history of a classic song, Professor Longhair's Tipitina.
When I heard that intro, those first four notes, it felt like a rite of passage to me.
That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today I'll talk with the writer Shalom Auslander. He left his ultra-religious upbringing for a life of sin.
Yeah, well, I like sinning. I was raised with 613 commandments. I'm on a sin roll for the rest of my life.
His new novel is called Hope, a Tragedy. But to start the show, the Cold War between the U.S. and Iran escalates practically by the day. They threaten an oil embargo. Another Iranian nuclear scientist is assassinated. We say we will not tolerate an Iranian nuclear weapon. They sentence an accused U.S. spy to death.
And the Golden Globe goes to... From Iran, A Separation.
Earlier this week, when the Iranian film A Separation won the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Film, in his acceptance speech, its director, Asghar Farhadi, went right to the present point.
But now, I just prefer to say something about my people. I think they are a truly peace-loving people. Thank you very much.
A Separation is a huge hit in Iran, while another new Iranian movie is being talked about, but not officially shown at all. The Hunter is by the director Rafi Pitts, who's been making films in Iran since 1997, but is now living in exile in Paris. His film is about a night security guard at a factory in Tehran whose wife and daughter are accidentally killed in a shootout between police and anti-government demonstrators. He loses it and goes rogue.
There are corrupt policemen. There are people who think that they have the laws in their hands. And so I wanted to just show that each of those people represented a way of thinking within the country, and to have the audience question on who is right and who is wrong mm-hmm. at the end of the day.
So shortly before that Golden Globe award that your colleague, your peer, received, the government in Iran shut down the biggest independent film institute in the country. What does that mean, and what is the state of Iranian cinema right now?
It's actually interesting. I hadn't heard Farhadi's speech at the Golden Globes. Listening to it now, it's as though I was listening to it live. And I think it's a shame he didn't dedicate his Golden Globe to the film industry, because the closing of the House of Cinema is a very big step from the authorities to close down our industry. They think that the House of Cinema is a place that is against the authorities, but it's a place where there's a lot of thought put into it and a lot of people meet and discuss the arts.
So that is the closing off, the pinching off of an important space of expression that has somehow had managed to exist until now?
Yes. I mean, it's extremely violent what's happened to us and within the industry. I mean, it all started, I remember when I was presenting my film The Hunter at the Berlin Film Festival in 2010. On the day of the screening of the film, Jafar Panahi's passport had been confiscated. He's another one of our great Iranian filmmakers. And he wasn't allowed to leave the country. This is in 2010, February 2010. In December 2010, he was sentenced alongside with another Iranian filmmaker, Rasulov, to 6 years imprisonment, 20 years of not being allowed to practice their profession, 20 years of not being able to leave the country. Now, they were both sentenced for this, for an idea of a film that they hadn't made.
Wow.
So a lot of things have been going on, and slowly but surely, the Iranian authorities have decided to close down the film industry.
Basically, you finish the film just as the election happens, just as the protests over the rigging of the election happened and everything went to hell. So you finish the film in Europe. At that point, did you decide, okay, I'm not going back to Iran?
Well, no, I still haven't decided I'm not going back to Iran. I would still like to go back to Iran. I never think of it in those terms.
Uh-huh.
But the violence for me was that I had done my film, I had made my film within the rules of my country, of the Board of Censorship, because mm-hmm. I wanted the film to be shown there.
Mm-hmm.
And the film became more and more political due to them,
yes,
not due to me as a filmmaker.
Yes.
You know. So the irony is that the Board of Censorship ended up making a political film.
The film is not being shown in Iran, except, I presume, being smuggled in on DVDs or BitTorrented, or probably people are seeing it. But how do you feel that in your country it's not being shown?
Well, very sad. I feel that today the Iranian film industry has been pushed back to the early days of the revolution, where cinema is frowned upon. Authorities in Iran should understand that what takes mankind forward is culture. So whether it be my film or any other filmmaker's film in Iran, I think it's a great shame that our government should think that we are against our country just because we want to pinpoint something that exists. I always say, as filmmakers, we hold up a mirror, but it's not our fault if anybody looks at themselves in the mirror and think they're ugly.
Mm-hmm.
All we're doing is holding up the mirror.
Yeah.
But if there's just one thing I'd love to say,
uh-huh.
is that I really hope from the bottom of my heart that if Asghar Farhadi gets the Oscar, and I really hope he does, that when he's on that stage, he won't forget that they closed the House of Cinema and they're closing down our industry.
Well, we'll have to wait for Oscar night to see if your wish comes true. Rafi Pitts, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Rafi Pitts is the writer, director, and star of the new movie The Hunter, which is playing in limited release in the United States. Not every home video demands repeat viewings, but there's one that my family keeps in heavy rotation. It's of me and Kate, my elder daughter. She was 2 years old back in 1990, and we're dancing and dancing around the living room to the Little Creatures album by Talking Heads. Talking Heads was my favorite band in my 20s and 30s, so I loved watching their new DVD, Chronology. It has film and video of Talking Heads going all the way back to 1975, when we were all young. David Byrne was the lead singer and songwriter. He's also been an influential music producer and curator, visual artist, biking activist, and several other things, including my guest today, David Byrne. Welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
Were you surprised at the popularity that you had, and that this success that came out of this arty little downtown band?
Yes and no. To be
well, I'm interested in the no.
Okay, you're interested in the no. All right. So I have to be sort of immodest and say that, like a lot of other bands, artists, everything else, at any period, really, you tend to think that the pervasive stuff around you is crap. And you and your friends
are doing the real stuff.
We're doing the real stuff. And optimistically, one might think, since we're doing the real stuff, and it has real soul and it passion and it's of its moment, it represents its moment. And so, immodestly, you think, of course, things are just going to fall into your lap because you're doing something that has some truth to it. That certainly doesn't always happen.
No. There is a montage on this DVD that is just you introducing a bunch of songs and looking so embarrassed and awkward. It almost hurts to watch, and I'm going to force you to watch it here with me for a moment.
This song was written a long time ago. This is
from March 1976.
The name of this song is Stay Hungry. The name of this song is, we call it In My Heart. This song was written more or less around the same period, as they say.
It's as though you're making fun of your own awkward, youthful self.
Well, yes, in putting together this montage, yes, it's kind of acknowledging this is a person who is profoundly uncomfortable addressing an audience, and yet puts himself in that position.
And not, as long as we're talking about him in the third person, why did he do that as this uncomfortable 23, 24-year-old?
Yes, if I can refer to my earlier self as in the third person, I think he did that because he had to. There was this means of communication that was being a performer and writing songs and singing them was a way of kind of being present to other people, not just girls, but other people in general, and maybe not exactly having a conversation, but at least
saying what you felt and thought.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Here is one of those performances from 35 years ago. I want to play that. This is I'm Not in Love.
We are two strangers. We might never have met. We could talk forever. I understand what you said, but I'm not in love. What does it take to fall in love? Do people really fall in love?
Do people really fall in love? Is such a great question, especially for a 22-year-old boy.
Sorry for laughing. It really, yeah. Maybe you and the listeners can tell. I'm a little bit more comfortable in myself and with other people now. But
no, you're a very clubbable man now.
Yes. But yes, I was just asking all the most super obvious questions. Why do humans, people, we do this? And how does that work? It was all just kind of, can I figure this out?
Yeah. You've said, I've seen it written that you said have said since that maybe you had Asperger's syndrome, which wasn't called that then. Do you think it would have made a difference in your being, in your life, in your behavior if you'd had a diagnosis, something to call it back then?
I don't see how it would have. If indeed I was somewhere along that spectrum. I was pretty relatively along a fairly functioning side.
Clearly, you started a band.
I started a band. I could actually get together with other band people and do it. I wasn't like so isolated that I could only stay in my room and work with a computer, but those computers sort of didn't exist then.
Exactly.
Yeah, you kind of felt like I have to figure out a way to fit in somehow.
Yeah.
And I might not be like everyone else. Nobody is.
Right.
But I have to figure that out. Instead of kind of having a million different labels for what my various kind of quirks might be.
This is from an old interview when you were young that's on this new DVD, Chronology. I want to play it.
I feel like I try to be a very moral person. I believe a lot of those moral cliches, like two wrongs don't make a right, and there's no such thing as a free lunch. And that if you do bad things, it'll come back to you, and all those sort of stupid things.
That, people, I think, at the time looked at that thinking, oh, he's some kind of Andy Warhol guy. He's not really serious about this. But it seems as though you really were serious and just speaking straightforwardly.
Yes, that was not an act. I might have been very uncomfortable speaking to the camera and saying that to the extent where it looks like I was performing or being ironic or whatever. But I wasn't. I was really trying to understand, what is it that I do believe? What's guiding my behavior?
And has another 30 years of life confirmed that basic understanding of right living?
For the most part, yeah. For the most part, I think we're kind of inundated or inoculated with those kind of things early on, and we kind of are stuck with them.
A couple of years ago, you released a record with another musical hero of mine, Brian Eno, called Everything That Happens Will Happen Today, and I want to play the title track off that album. It also sounds to me like a Beatles song, but what is that song about?
I think that's a 9/11 song. There's talks about explosions on the road and asking if your brother's all right. But oddly enough, in that it came out of that time and that era when politically here I was feeling kind of pretty angry and alienated. These songs came out that were kind of positive alternatives to that.
And this song didn't make it to this record for some years after 9/11. So maybe by that time you had come to some kind of reconciliation?
Yeah, I think it took a while to kind of process that, to get past kind of the initial anger and frustration and confusion and then kind of think about, you know, what our lives are about and what matters.
You've got a book coming out, I see, later this year called How Music Works, which is a nicely grand and straightforward seeming title. What is it going to be?
Yeah, the title's a little bit exaggerated, but not exactly. Some things I've kind of talked about or written about before. So there's one chapter about music business, how it's changed over the years, the various ways that an emerging artist can get their stuff out there.
That's interesting. And nitty-gritty.
Yeah, it's real nitty-gritty, and there's pie charts and numbers and how many records get sold and how much you get if you do this and what your income will be and all that kind of thing. And then there's other ones that are a little more esoteric. There's one about kind of music of the spheres and Pythagoras, and that music was considered a science up until like the Renaissance, and then it came pushed over into the humanities and the arts in a beautiful kind of poetic way. For much of human history, it was thought that the universe was guided by music, which is, maybe we should rethink that idea.
So here's how to make it in music. And by the way, here's why you ought to be interested in music, I guess.
A little bit, yeah.
Do you ever, as you're listening to pop music, do you ever say, oh, I see a little of my DNA in this young person's work?
The embarrassing part is I find that I don't notice that right away. A friend will point it out, and it'll be embarrassing because it'll be like, well, okay, that's why I like that group so much.
Oh, I get that, yeah. David Byrne, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. Yeah, that was fun.
The Talking Heads DVD called Chronology is out now. What's up? You might get what you're asking. little later in the show, one of our listeners will tell us how a Talking Heads record saved her life. And in just a minute, our crack team of graphic designers reveals their whole new visual language for education.
Our goal was to create a language that really captured the sophistication of teaching.
What represents teachers better than Apple or abacus or a ruler?
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell.
Rebranding teachers for the 21st century. That's up next in Studio 360. From PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. For about the last 5 years, every so often we've hired graphic design teams to rethink various cherished symbols. Valentine's Day, the gay flag, the Monopoly board. To decide on our newest target for a redesign, we went to you, our listeners.
An apple for the teacher. That seems the thing to do.
A teacher wrote in frustrated with the corny old-fashioned visual junk teachers get stuck with. Apples, ABCs, 1-2-3s, one-room schoolhouses with bells on top. We especially liked the phrase she used for this, apple crapple. And we asked teachers around the country what they might want to see instead of that stuff. Then we gave those ideas to a team of professionals, a New York design firm called Hyperact. Hyperact's co-principals are Julia Vaxer-Zeltzer and D. Roy Peraza. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having us.
Here's a handsome handsome deck that you've created that I haven't looked at. This is an authentic reveal. It says Studio 360 Rebranding Teachers. Walk me through this.
Well, our goal was to create a language that really captured the sophistication of teaching.
We look for metaphors to figure out what they could be, what represents teachers better than Apple or an abacus or a ruler. And as we were looking for inspiration, we came across this amazing quote by Mark Van Doren. He said, "The art of teaching is the art of assisting discovery." And with that idea, we went looking for the visual.
Hyperact is eight designers, so eight of us took to the pencil and just sketched our hearts out for a couple days and threw everything up on the wall.
There was arrows, radiating sun, compass. All these ideas were guiding us in some way.
And I want to let listeners know that as we're talking right now, they can look through this presentation along with us online at studio360.org.
What we really liked about this quote as a guiding light was that teachers,
assisting discovery.
Yeah, it's assisting discovery, but it's not dictators of knowledge. They are guides. They help you as a student connect the dots. So this concept of connecting the dots, we felt, really had this exciting potential. Visual maps, like teachers, help learners in many different ways of learning.
Everybody doesn't read a map the same way.
Exactly. But you can do so many things with maps. You can brainstorm ideas. You can reveal relationships. You can explain processes, tell stories.
Also, connecting the dots, in addition to being a visual thing, has a in the language, a well-known, well-understood.
Right, it's a formation of ideas.
Yeah.
It's ideas forming before you.
As the client, let me say, I love maps. So you're
we're clear.
We love maps as well.
Well, that made a whole lot of sense because connecting the dots was already part of the visual language in the classroom. Say you look at the molecular structure, there are connections.
Circuit boards.
Yeah. That's right.
So you hit on the idea. You said that's the idea, and then actually you started. And I'm happy to see that. I was going to ask you about colors, but then I think, oh, that'll seem too superficial. But here you have a whole page about colors.
Yeah. It's all in the warm yellow family. School bus uses yellow. A notepad. You'll find them yellow as well. Pencils,
right.
Sticky notes, all of this.
Orangish yellow.
Once we identify the idea, the connecting of the dots, identify the color, we went on to look for the right typeface. We found a typeface called Chevin. We felt like it was a proud, friendly, yet serious typeface with a modern touch to it.
Although it looks like a typeface, it's sans serif, and it looks like something that might be used to suggest a primer, education, an alphabet in a classroom, in a good way, which is to say, like the yellow or orange, you're going for familiar-looking resonances.
Right, but staying away from big bubble letters.
Right.
Because, again, we don't want to...
Comic Sans.
Right. we don't want to talk just to the six-year-old. We put all of that stuff together, our concept of connecting the dots, the color palette of yellow, the warm yellow, Chevin as the base typeface for the brand, and we thought about a brand. And we decided to use, instead of using the word teacher, we shortened it and turned it into the verb teach. Because teach is a call to action. We can use it to remind people the importance of teaching. Teach, it's important. We can connect it to subject areas. Teach science, teach math. Part of each letter is connected in linear form, but part of it is left as dots to be connected.
These are works in progress.
They're works in progress. And we wanted to create the metaphor in the word mark that this is about connecting the dots, but it's not about having teachers connect all the dots for you.
And they could be connected in various ways. You can connect them
Absolutely.
In a color. You could connect them in a zigzaggy line, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it leaves some indeterminacy, which good education should.
And then we really had fun taking it into things like
the merchandise.
Bathroom signage
yes.
and the merchandise and stuff. And so with the bathroom signs, again, it's creating the figure of the icons of the woman and the man out of these connected dots,
partially
which are partially
connected.
Left unconnected.
And here you encourage children to have tattoos.
Temporary yeah. tattoos.
Who doesn't want a tattoo?
yeah.
Temporary tattoos.
Cool. That heart tattoo made up of dots is beautiful. I'd get that.
Yeah, so this is a school pride campaign. How can we do something that's not cheesy, that stays in the same visual language that that students might be able to own? And so it's the letter I made up of dots connected by lines. A heart made up of dots of different sizes, a cloud of dots, and our symbol for school, which is this kind of massive dots connected by lines in under a shelter.
So people can take it and mess around with it whatever way they want.
Sure.
Yeah, it's not some pure, clean, brand Bible way.
Yeah, we don't want it to feel corporate. The greatest brands are the ones that kind of spread into our culture seamlessly and kind of get transformed by what people do to them, right?
Sold. This is great. This is fantastic. And for all those, I don't know, Gates Foundation executives listening or anybody else who has a serious interest in communicating the importance of teachers and schools and education, go to studio360.org and take a look. This is really, really extraordinary.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We had a blast.
Julia Vaxer-Zeltzer and DeRoy Peraza are the principals of the design firm HyperAct. You can see images of their proposed teacher rebranding and a video of them at work at studio360.org. And while you're at our website, tell us what you think. Tell me one more time, people, now. What do you say? Without an education, you might as well. One more time. What do you say? Without an education, might as well. Stay in school. Have a good time. All this month, we are spotlighting music chosen last year by the Library of Congress for its National Recording Registry. Today, the story of Tipitina. It was by the New Orleans piano player Henry Roland Byrd, better known as Professor Longhair. A former street hustler turned self-taught musician, he only started recording music when he was in his 30s. Atlantic Records released Tipitina in 1953. At first, it was a hit only in New Orleans, but it's gone on to inspire generations of musicians, including three who are going to tell us its story.
I'm Alan Toussaint of New Orleans, and I'm a songwriter, pianist, arranger, producer, and a disciple of Professor Longhair.
My name is Irma Thomas. I am a professional singer, been in the business for 51 years, and I'm also a Grammy winner. Thank you, Lord.
My name is Hugh Laurie. I am an actor, but also something of a musician, and I recently recorded a, version of Tipitina. It's a song that I've always loved.
Tipitina, tra-la-la-la, oh-la-la-la.
I mean, I must have been exposed to all kinds of New Orleans music from a much younger age, but I suppose the first one I was really conscious of was Professor Longhair.
Roy Bird, yes, Fess. His influence is all over the culture of New Orleans because it was so off the beaten path from everything else. And then when Tipitina came along and I heard that intro, those first rolls on those first four notes, I approached that right away, of course, to learn it, and it felt like a rite of passage to me.
There was something about that record that started to bring Professor Longhair back into the public consciousness, because he'd been sort of exiled in a way, and he was working as a doorman, and he was sweeping up in nightclubs and couldn't get a gig. And in the later part of his life, he was anointed to his rightful position as king of the New Orleans piano players.
Hello.
In 1953, that record was everywhere. I mean, as a kid, you heard it at least seven or eight times a day. And, of course, it was very popular at the parade that year for Mardi Gras. If you know your history of New Orleans is a city of gumbo when it comes to ethnicity. And Professor Longhead, he was a local personality and played a lot of his music with that underlying Caribbean tempo.
It definitely always had a very dominant rhythm, and his technique was superb, impeccable for what he was doing.
He was different. His music was just different. It was the kind of music that you could not sit still and listen to. And it was a one-of-a-kind type of adventure when you listened to him. You know, when the record started playing, you knew it was a Professor Longhair record.
And he had that, of course, that interesting vernacular that you were so drawn to. It was magnetic.
What is a oola mala walla dollar dollar?
The sort of ti-na-na thing is an old New Orleans sort of musical chant, but I don't really know what Tipitina means.
I've heard that it was some island that someone knew about.
I don't know if it's a place or a drink.
I've heard that it was just something that someone just felt like saying.
Or a skin complaint. I've no idea. And actually didn't want to know. I thought it's better not knowing. It adds to its mystique, and it's part of make me laugh and cry in all in one go.
For us in New Orleans and many other places, many people who don't even know Fess, I can hear in their playing that they have heard someone who heard someone who heard someone who knew Fess. And of course, I bow to that.
We're gonna dip a drawl of Mala Walla, drink that mellow, mellow wine.
Alan Toussaint, Hugh Laurie, and Irma Douglas talking about Professor Longhair's song Tipitina. Our story was produced by Eric Byth. And at Studio360.org, you can hear all the stories in our series from inside the National Recording Registry. We've got Loretta Lynn talking about Coal Miner's Daughter, Billy Crystal on The 2,000-Year-Old Man, and a lot more. Coming up, Anne Frank, alive and living in the attic of some yuppie's farmhouse, according to a new novel by Shalom Auslander.
And she was a handful as a 12-year-old, fought with her mother constantly, had no patience for the religious kids, and Holocaust or no Holocaust, I think she was going to grow up to be kind of a difficult woman. And I like that. I like difficult people.
Soft and sweet, let me hold it close and keep it here with me.
The writer Shalom Auslander. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Shalom Auslander's last book, Foreskin's Lament, was a funny and dark memoir about growing up in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish household, and then his struggle to break free from that life as he became an adult. Auslander has now written his first novel, Hope, a Tragedy. It's about a Jewish man named Solomon Kugel, who moves with his wife and small son to a farmhouse in rural upstate New York, and then discovers there's a very old lady living in his attic. He demands to know who she is, and she claims to be Anne Frank. Shalom Auslander, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. Oh, it's her, all right.
It's her. Oh, really? You settled that? Oh, great. I'm glad to know that.
Oh, it's her.
So, can you start us off with the reading a bit of this
sure.
funny, strange novel?
Right. So he's up there, and he's found her hiding behind a wall of storage boxes. Kugel looked at her, trying to decide if she was real or if this was something else, a dream, a nightmare, maybe a hallucination. He hadn't slept well in a while. The stench, though, convinced him it was real. "I'm calling the police," he said. He snapped off his flashlight and backed toward the stairs, afraid to turn away from her. She waved in annoyance again, shuffled forward out of the eaves, settled in front of the computer, and, as if nothing at all out of the ordinary had occurred, began to type. That was the sound, the tapping of the keyboard. He'd been hearing it for days. Kugel stopped at the head of the attic stairs. "And let me tell you something else," he said. She continued to type, paying him no attention. "I don't know who you are," he said, "or how you got up here, but I'll tell you what I do know. I know Anne Frank died in Auschwitz, and I know that she died along with many others, some of whom were my relatives. And I know that making light of that, by claiming to be Anne Frank, not only is not funny and abhorrent, but it also insults the memory of millions of victims of Nazi brutality." The old woman stopped typing and turned to him, fixing that hideous yellow eye upon his. "It was Bergen-Belsen, jackass," she said. Kugel continued to glare at her, even though he felt a flush of shame color his face. He turned and began climbing down the stairs. "And as for the relatives you lost in the Holocaust," she continued. Kugel stopped and looked at her, and when he did, she yanked up her shirt sleeve, revealing the fading blue-black concentration camp numbers tattooed on the inside of her pale forearm. "Blow me," said Anne Frank.
I'm afraid. I felt bad for smiling and chuckling aloud as I read that passage. That's Shalom Auslander reading from his novel Hope, a Tragedy. Through Anne Frank, whom I now know is actually Anne Frank in this novel, we get to a discussion of the focus among Jews in the culture and history and the discourse on the Holocaust 50 and 60 years later, which I guess, I mean, you take some issue with.
Well, it's a question. I mean, for me, it's the big question. What do I do with this now? The Holocaust was my personal benchmark for badness. It could have been anything if I raised somewhere else. And so the question is, now what? What do I do now? What do I do looking back in 2012 at the history of mankind? How do I go on? What do I tell my kid? What does Kugel tell Jonah?
His little three-year-old son.
Yeah. I was told that I was born with a target on my back, that as a Jew, you are targeted.
And Kugel's mother goes that and then some in terms of how she's raised Kugel.
Yeah, and she talks about her time in the camps, but she never was in the camps.
She was born in 1945.
Right, in Brooklyn. And she just has internalized it to such a degree, and perhaps it's her illness, perhaps it's age, but perhaps it's just a coping mechanism. So I don't know that in any character in the book I associate with myself. I think every one of these characters, whether it's Anne Frank deciding that the safest place she's ever felt was in an attic, or mother determining that complete paranoia and fear is the way to protect yourself, or Kugel, who just wants to move to a town where nothing ever happened and forget about it, I'm all of those things.
You have Anne Frank sort of get what seems to be the last word on this, since she is, after all, Anne Frank, who says, "I think never forgetting the Holocaust is not the same as never shutting up about it."
Right. And she was a handful as a 12-year-old, fought with her mother constantly, had no patience for the religious kids. And I think that that's kind of a cool kid. I kind of like that.
So when she curses and bullies Kugel, you're thinking this is what Anne Frank might have been.
Holocaust or no Holocaust, I think she was going to grow up to be kind of a difficult woman. And I like that. I like difficult people. And I ended up finishing the book, and I kind of, she went from being this historical figure that I just didn't ever want to see a picture of again, to a fictional character in my mind that's replaced that person who I feel a lot worse for. There's something about, and Kugel and his wife argue about this in the book, about whether life is always better than death, and survival better than succumbing. But there is something to, boy, if she had survived and was so disturbed by this and had been...
So disturbed by?
By what she had been through, that the only time she could really remember warmly was in an annex with her family before they were all torn apart, that maybe she would decide after escaping from Bergen-Belsen in the last days of the war that that's where she wants to be. That's the safest place.
Since she is you call her the Jewish Jesus, she is the modern saint, a modern saint. Once you really decided, okay, I'm going to do this, did it feel transgressive for very long? Or, I mean, it's
in a good way.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, I like sinning.
There you go.
I was raised with 613 commandments. I'm on a sin roll for the rest of my life.
Growing up, you said you read a lot. What did you read? What did you watch on TV? What was your cultural life as a young person?
Well, it was funny because in my first school, which was very orthodox, even more so than later, you weren't allowed to have a television. The television was the tool of Satan, of Satan. Except
you were Amish, practically.
Except in 1979, when ABC did a 7-hour miniseries on the Holocaust, and all of a sudden, it was mandatory that you had to watch it, which was like probably for me one of the first great examples.
When you were 9 years old,
yeah, oh. It was like one of the great first moments of hypocrisy, of religious hypocrisy. You can't have a TV except to watch the Holocaust. But what ended up happening was I went to yeshiva in uptown, like 180th Street, and I used to cut school to go down to Times Square and buy pornography. And just by happenstance, the bus stop for the bus that went back to Muncie was
the town
I came
from. Near New York.
Yeah. The bus picked up, and this is like almost godlike written. It picked up in front of Gotham Bookmart, which was this fantastic bookstore that no longer exists. And I just started buying books. And the first book I bought was, just because it was purple and it stood out, was a book of short stories by Leonard Michels. And I remember sitting on this bus. This is a religious bus. So there's a curtain down the middle. Men sit on one side. Women sit on the other. There's a Torah and an ark for prayers. And I'm sitting there and I open this book. And it's a story about these three Jewish kids who go up to the rooftop to spy on their rabbi and his wife having sex. And then one night, the night of the story, the guy turns and sees them and they panic and a kid slips and falls and dies. And I was like, wow, are there more of these? So I read a lot of things by him. And then someone at the bookstore said, oh, if you like that, you know, for whatever reason, I said it was really funny and dark. Is there anything like that? They put me onto Kafka, and from there I went to Beckett. But
So buying books at a literary bookstore was your gateway drug to apostasy.
It was. And the best part was that I wasn't in school for it. I wasn't being told by a professor what it meant. So I was shocked to find out that people took this all very seriously, that Beckett was a god in that world. And I was both surprised and disappointed. Because, and I still am, because literature is very religious, and I dislike that part.
You mean the religious hush that goes over art and art museums and literature?
Yes.
And all that?
Yes, and who's the new prophet and who are the dead prophets and what does the Bible of the New York Times say? And it's stifling and it's hurting it, as religion tends to do.
And at what point did you break free, or was that a work in progress over many years?
Yeah, that's like losing a toenail. It takes a lot longer than it should because you don't want to just yank it off.
Did they know? Did they see at 14, 15 that there was Shalom has problems?
Well, I think the police department let them know that.
Oh, really? You acted out.
I acted out. I shoplifted, got high a lot, and then went to Israel and got very religious all over. I was all over the place because I was just trying to find somewhere that I fit. And I think back then, if you told me the place I'm going to fit is sitting and writing books that are dark and funny and about Anne Frank, I would have thought you were crazy. But that's somehow how it happened.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Shlomo Auslander's new novel, Hope, a Tragedy, is out right now. To close the show today, one more Talking Heads story. But this time, I'm not the super fan. It's from Studio 360 listener Amy Douglas. She was a teenager when her parents sent her off to a boarding school in the Arizona desert. She struggled and fell into a depression. But then a cassette of live performances by Talking Heads kind of helped save her life. Really.
I had grown up really, really fast and at the same time was a pretty angry kid. And started drinking all the time, staying out all weekend, stealing the car, failing classes, pretty angry. And my parents just didn't know what to do. I was a little bit out of control. And then right before the school year was supposed to start, they said, you're going away to boarding school. They popped me in the car and we drove to Arizona. And it was in the middle of the high Arizona desert, like 75 miles north of Phoenix. And remember when they dropped me off, I just looked at them and I just screamed, you are not leaving me here. You are not leaving me here. And I think it was probably one of the hardest things they ever had to do. But they did, and they drove away. Prior to going away to boarding school, I was a really big athlete, and I had all this extra energy and anger, and I just turned it inwards. And as a punishment to myself, probably, and as a punishment to them, I became anorexic and lost about quite a bit of weight. For me, I'm pretty small. I'm only 5'3", and I got down to like 87 pounds, and I just really self-destructed. One day, a friend said to me something like, you just need to eat. And I started eating. And what happens when you've lost all that weight is your metabolism's way messed up. I ended up gaining a whole bunch of weight. And then I got this album. I go visit him. I talk loud. I try to make myself hear. For me, the name of this band is the Talking Heads. That album was full of energy and really helped me to become alive again. Just the music and the energy of it just made me want to go out and run. It was my solace and it was my motivator to reconnect with my body in a way that I had been completely disconnected from, to become friends with it again. And I wore that tape out. I really did. Don't worry about the government. Just the way that that song starts. Just the way it starts. It's just beautiful. Because it's just so delicate. And then all of a sudden, boom. And then there we go. And we're on the ride. And this would be another great one to run to. Just because, as I explained, when I would run, you would just have this vista, you know, this is the high Arizona desert, and you can just see forever. And this song, to me, has an expansiveness about it, you know, especially here I am in the high Arizona desert where there's no buildings anywhere. I mean, I can just remember running on the dirt road every day, and the music, it just was pounding, and it was just so, there was just so much energy in it, and finally feeling the strength and the life in my body coming back.
Loved ones, visit the building, take the highway, park, and come up and see me, I'll be waiting.
Listener Amy Douglas talking about the record The Name of This Band is Talking Heads. Our story was produced by Ada Birnir. Is there some record that changed your life, or a book or a movie or some other work of art? If so, we'd like to hear about it. Tell us at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
John Delore,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. Our series Inside the National Recording Registry receives support from the Library of Congress.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the amazing inventor Nikola Tesla makes a new friend.
Mark Twain and Tesla became very, very close after Tesla cured Mark Twain's constipation, which he did by having Mark Twain stand on a metal plate and running an electric charge through his entire body.
Performer Mike Daisy on the genius Nikola Tesla. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.